is the Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate. Now, this show follows the November 6th election, the election we were told would change everything. It didn't. That becomes clearer every day, from the escalating attacks on the press, to the thousands of troops being sent to the border, to the firing of Jeff Sessions for, among other things, not using his office to attack Trump's enemies. So, at the back end of the show, I'll be reading a statement from Refuse Fascism on the elections, why some victories for the Democrats doesn't really stop the direction or momentum of the Trump-Pence fascist regime, and why people must act. Before that, we'll hear a short speech by Sansara Taylor from a November 7th protest, talking about the elections, the future we face, and the real revolution that humanity needs. And before that, we'll hear from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, on how to spread the fighting spirit confronting fascists despite what Dems say. This is from the Q&A that followed a speech he gave this summer, Why We Need an Actual Revolution and How We Can Really Make Revolution. And you can access that speech itself at revcom.us. And opening the show up, I'm really pleased to welcome back to the show David Palumbo Liu, the Louise Hewlett Nixon Professor at Stanford University. He's a professor of comparative literature and English, a human rights activist and author. So let's hear my conversation with David Palumbo Liu. The one thing you can say for sure right now is that each week things are going to get more and more just amazingly bad, okay, in terms of what the Trump regime, the fascist regime of Trump is doing to this country, in this country, and around the world, to people around the world. Now, recently, Donald Trump announced that he is an unapologetic nationalist, and it's even more likely that violent repression of anti-fascist demonstrations will occur in response to all this. And while Trump didn't affix any prefix to nationalist, his actions speak loudly for the fact that he favors a specific definition of who is counted in his nation. Joining us to talk about all this is David Palumbo Liu. Now, David is the Louise Hewlett Nixon Professor and Professor of Comparative Literature and by courtesy English at Stanford University. He's written many scholarly books, and he's part of the public intellectual project at Truthout and blogs for Salon, The Nation, and The Huffington Post. And you can follow him on Twitter at Palumbo Liu. That's P as in Peter, A-L-U-M-B-O-L-I-U. And David is joining us to talk about his article, Trump's Embrace of Nationalist Label is the Final Link to a Dangerous Pattern. David, welcome to the show.
Hey, thank you for having me.
Sure. Now, I have to say, I recently read this piece of yours that made me really want to talk with you. It's Trump's Embrace of Nationalist Label is Final Link to Dangerous Pattern. And I wanted to dig into that because I think two things. One, I think that not enough people actually really understand that and understand what's going on with that and what the cost of that is, what's going to happen, what the repercussions will be. But mm-hmm. they also, not only did they not understand it, but there's actually, then what exactly does that mean? So I wanted to ask you, you open up your article talking about the significance and consequences of Trump declaring himself an unapologetic nationalist. Let's dig into that because that's a big, big, very important opening for people to understand in terms of what's being done in the society today.
Right, because, you know, I've had people making comments or emailing me and saying, well, you know, he never said white nationalists, are you really, you know, filling in this blank irresponsibly? And I say to them, well, fine, just look at what he's doing instead of wondering about whether he needs to stay white or not, because all of his actions make it very clear that when he says, well, I'm just saying that I'm for America, you know, he has a very particular idea of what America is and who he's responsible to, and it's certainly not, you know, a lot of people that you would normally think of as being part of our society. You know, it's very the erasure of trans people, the banning of Muslims, the horrible work against migrants and refugees, his incredible misogynism. It's very, very clear that when he talks about the nation that he's advancing, it's a white cis-based nation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. And I would say even there's even more, and you get into this in a lot of what you've written about, but there's actually a point here of you know, we're living in a time when fascism is not something that's sort of like, it existed, 50 years ago or something. Mm. Or it's in some other place, and the rulers of this country end up calling, you know, these banana republics that have fascist rulers that are just all this. You know, it's actually, this is what's shaping up and taking shape. And I think a lot of what, when you talked about Trump's embrace of nationalist label, it really made me think about how quickly and how far advanced it is, this move towards actually a fascist rule in this country.
Right, because you can look at the primary attributes of fascism and see them all over Trump, but what makes some people reluctant to apply the label is exactly as you say, they've relegated into the past, and there might be authoritarian figures, but it doesn't rise to the occasion of Adolf Hitler. I mean, it's sort of sitting, you know, in that realm. But I think what I'm trying to do, and other people are trying to do, like yourself, in calling attention to this, is to look at the apparatus. The apparatus is very, very contemporary, but it's, again, feeding off of the same kinds of ethno-nationalist fears, the same kind of attack on our basic institutions, including the media, of course, you know, the attack on the truth in general. But working through social media, working through these alt-right groups that are both very visible but also very subterranean, and taking advantage of sort of our liberal institutions that are still calling it a matter of free speech. And that's my frustration with the academy when they say, well, you know, we have to allow these people their right to debate, and they're not interested in debating. They're interested in coming and causing harm. So when you put all the pieces together, it certainly is a very formidable form of fascism that we have to recognize in all of its constituent parts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you know, it's on the one hand, you have Trump as sort of like the titular head of this. At the same time, there is this whole fascist thing, opposition that's developing, as you're saying, and it's both in an organized way as well as what we've seen over the last couple of months, as well as a sort of general call to independent fascists to actually come into action themselves, but to join with the overall grouping. So when you look at these forces in society, it kind of tells you a little bit about how dangerous things are right now.
Absolutely. I mean, that's one of the things that the internet has provided folks is these ways to formally and informally, either in a very consistent way or in a very random way, tap into these news feeds and these hate groups that are just spewing nonsense. But if it's the nonsense makes you comfortable and gives you a sense of worthiness and gives you a sense of solidarity with people outside of your immediate group of contacts, then you go for it. And that's what Trump has feeded into. He's fed into this. He's famous for his dog whistles and his non-dog whistles. I mean, he's just flat out there stirring up hatred. And then you get people like Tucker Carlson saying, well, you know, he deplores the fact that there's such, you know, divisiveness in the country. Well, I mean, that's his job. You know, everybody makes these very cynical gestures toward, you know, let's back off and recombine as a polity. But the temperature of this country has gotten to be so high that it's not only volatile, but it's also very dangerous in terms of the way that words are then put into action, as we've seen in the last few weeks.
Yeah, absolutely. And now, David, one of the things you make a point in all of this, that the kind of political development that we're talking about actually sends up very serious danger signals. And you say that this completes an already existing set of connections that makes it very dangerous. What exactly are we talking about here?
Well, it's somewhat of what we were just talking about, in that you have a president who has basically eviscerated most of the checks and balances that we rely on, and then he's gone after the media. And he is partnering with groups like the Proud Boys and Identity Europa and Turning Point USA, some of which invite him or his minions to come and speak at their gatherings. So you have this formal structure of white nationalist, white supremacist groups partnering with the White House. And when Trump says, you know, there are good people on both sides, very fine people on both sides, you know, their ears prick up and they blast it all over their websites saying that he's endorsed them and he's not disavowed them in any serious way. And then the part of the puzzle I have been noticing, which is really disturbing, is that the police have been complicit with allowing certain kinds of violence to go on unfettered and clamping down on anti-fascist protest. And the media, not only Fox News, but mainstream media, just loves to bash Antifa. And so they will edit their news coverage in really, really distortive ways so that you see anti-fascists protecting themselves or protecting other people without seeing what has preceded it, which is largely a matter of fascists attacking them quite brutally. And the police turn a blind eye to that, and they arrest the anti-fascists, and that forms the, you know, that completes the circle of this narrative that then again feeds back into Trump saying, you know, anti-fascists are mobs. In fact, he's even called standard liberals who are protesting him mobs. So he's, again, using this very inflammatory and irresponsible language to put these things together. And as I say in my article, the Guardian ran a piece about the Berkeley police reaction to demonstrations over the summer, and they actually have a formal policy of putting out demonstrators' IDs, and so they act as a kind of doxing platform, the Berkeley police themselves. So that's what's really scary, is that there's this linkage between these different levels, and then the media, you know, feeding the public that story that seems to confirm the worst fears of the fascists, and empowers them. When the Proud Boys had their, you know, event at the Republican Club in Manhattan, I mean, that's pretty explicit about how they are not afraid to, not only not afraid to, but they're anxious to form partnerships, and the White House did not disavow them at all.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with David Palumbo-Liu, and we're talking about his article that was in Truth Out called Trump's Embrace of Nationalist Label is Final Link to Dangerous Pattern. You know, I keep thinking, too, about how this all ties together in the overall framework we started out talking about in terms of nationalism, but also also this question of the redefinition of law and order to actually basically set loose the police with full... They can do whatever they want. They can be as brutal as they want. They can be whatever. There's no boundaries on what they can or can't do.
Absolutely. The state, no matter what state it is supposed to have the monopoly on violence, but it's supposed to be violence that conforms to the law. But, you know, Trump's pardoning of Arpaio in Arizona, a convicted felon, you know, sent a message, and he's made public statements before, again, his base, police unions, encouraging them to be brutal. So this whole notion of violence, both in terms of those that are slipping outside of their usual authority to be able to use weaponry and massive resources to inflict violence on protesters, to just vigilante groups that feel emboldened by the president not harnessing them, and then the press legitimating violence against peaceful demonstrators or demonstrators that are simply defending themselves. It's become both official and unofficial. And just one more thing I would add before you take over is that we have to look at this on the international scene as well. I mean, this lawlessness is when you have somebody like John Bolton being our representative and saying all the institutional frameworks for international law and diplomacy are holding America back, and he's not going to be contained by them, then you see the lawlessness projected upon the international scene, which, of course, now with Bolsonaro and with Modi and with Netanyahu and other authoritarian leaders, you know, that's setting up a kind of lawlessness on the international level as well.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, one of the things, too, that got me is that you spoke about the alliance between the White House and fascist groups, which people I don't think really get. You talked about the Proud Boys and stuff like that a little bit earlier. But there's actually a position that the Trump regime has of actually making nice with fascist groups.
Yeah, no, they will. I mean, Steve Bannon, Gorka, I mean, all these folks that were, you know, surrounding Trump during the campaign and in the first iteration of the White House, they were, you know, the people would call them out, and they would even, you know, declare their own allegiances to certain groups or certain ideologies. But I think it was sort of what, you know, we've been calling the shock doctrine. People were in such shock that they were just sort of wondering what else could happen. But Trump, again, has allied himself with these groups. He's said that they're misunderstood. He's saying that they're just proud Americans and they're concerned about their own groups. And when you listen to people at Identity Europa, they refuse the label racist. They say they're identitarian. So they're trying to leech out all of the bigotry and simply make it a matter of self-defense, which again plays into this element that Trump himself embraces. I mean, he says he's the most attacked president. Melania says she's the most bullied person in the face of the earth. So they paint themselves as victims, and of course a lot of their base see themselves also as victims, and you ask who is victimizing them? Well, of course, people that are different from them, and they're just absolutely beside themselves at the thought that they don't have control anymore.
And that's part of this thing that you bring up too, which I thought was also very insightful in terms of this, you know, what you describe as embracing victimization as an excuse for brutality. That's really an important element here.
Yes, because it somehow justifies it, makes you simply a matter of defending your turf, when in actuality it's based on very little actual empirical data. And Trump is a master at building up people's fears. I mean, if you think of, you know, you watch the Republican National Convention, it was like Armageddon was around the corner. Giuliani was just completely unhinged. But the crowd loved it because it was saying, not only are these folks recognizing how endangered we actually are, but they are going to protect us. And so that it was that transit between the fear into this huge sense of empowerment that's been toxic and exhilarating at the same time for these people.
Mm-hmm. You know, one of the things that I wanted to get into as well is this. It's just sort of, you know, we've been talking about the cops and Trump supporters and the alt-right hate groups and all this. And it really is important that people understand that there's a very special role. And I know you began to speak about this, but I'd like to dig into it a little bit more. There's a very special role of the police in all this, you know, and people need to understand that.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it's a scary time for folks of my generation when we look to the FBI for protection, because there was recently a New York Times op-ed saying, well, you know, the FBI was not diligent enough in tracking white supremacist groups, and now it's too late. They've overflowed the capacity for the FBI. Well, the FBI was never very interested in white supremacist groups, and it was a very low priority compared to them, you know, coming down on the Black Panthers and other groups, other militant groups. So the police are not only armed with official authority, but they're armed with unofficial authority and informal authority, and they are very well armed. I mean, we have a very militarized police force, and what's bizarre is that some of the weaponry that they have from their surplus war materials from Afghanistan, of course, they get them, but if they don't use them, then the government will take them back. It's a very strange feeder in which, you know, if you don't prove that you need these tanks, then they'll be taken back. And so the police are very receptive and very willing to be able to use anything as a pretext to use this arsenal of weaponry. So it's something. I was at the protest at Berkeley, and they were protecting the fascists. They really were setting up a buffer zone, and they were paying more attention to the anti-fascists because we were, frankly, there were more of us. But still, their priority was keeping the fascists safe, and the fascists were then provoking anti-fascists to react. It's a situation where, the normal institutions that one would think would work a certain way are really being used against the purposes to which they were organized. Yeah.
Let me remind listeners that you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with David Palumbo-Liu, and we're talking about his article that was in Truthout called Trump's Embrace of Nationalist Label is Final Link to Dangerous Pattern. Yeah, absolutely. And in terms of that, it is, you know, there is that very, you know, it's interesting when you're talking about what's going on with the police and what they did. I'm not somebody who's just like stepped out of the puddle in the middle, you know, a year ago or something. I was active as a revolutionary in the 60s, and I'm continuing to do this today. But there's also, you know, I kept looking at this whole point of, you know, when you talk about the role of the police and all the things the police did, it wasn't just like one thing there. They actually, you know, it was they went overboard to really sort of point out the people and to unleash, to enable these other fascists to come in and unleash everything they have against the protesters.
No, that's exactly it. And then of course, those that are victimized by the police are, you know, anytime there's any kind of organized resistance, we're looked upon as being terrorists, right?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
In other words, obviously we can't turn to the police for protection, so we protect each other, and then all of a sudden that the very fact that we're organized, it becomes another weapon to be used against us, right? We're going to be, I mean, anytime you look at an account of Antifa activities, it's completely distorted. You know, you think there are thousands of Antifa, not only demonstrators, which there are often enough, but that we're all armed to the teeth and beating innocent civilians. I mean, that's just not happening. But that's the narrative, again, that I'm concerned about, because nobody's repudiating it, not even the mainstream press. And so it's very, very dangerous. It's almost impossible to get a counter-narrative out there.
Mm-hmm. And there's two things that I was thinking about in relation to this. The first one is actually, you know, when you go back and you do, you know, you started to speak to this earlier, but you go back and you think about this, you know, this whole point about when the police are doing this, that they're actually speaking, one of the audiences that they're speaking to are these lone wolves that are out there, you know, and
exactly.
That we've seen a lot going on, this horrible stuff that's been going on with the threats of killings and the actual killings. And this is a big part of what they're doing there.
Yeah, absolutely. They always want to, you know, wash their hands clean of any of the effects of their speech or their physical violence. And yet, they're creating an atmosphere, and again, it's not just them, it's this powerful combination of all these forces we've been talking about that makes it almost inevitable that there will be violence and that there will be disproportionate violence against one group, and that's the protesters, because they will be the ones that are the least protected and whose acts of defense are always going to be looked at as acts of aggression. So thank you for your show and for other folks that are getting the story out as best we can, but when you talk to people, if you travel around the country and you talk to people, you know, they really are buying the line that the media feeds them. I mean, the Tucker Carlson, you know, story. You know, I've had cousins of mine that are rather conservative living in Texas saying, well, do you defend this? I mean, they were breaking down his door and, you know, threatening his wife. And of course, it's ironic that after, you know, you and I have been talking about the police, but the police report actually is fairly objective in saying, you know, there was no attack and the only vandalism there was some spray painting. But that's not the media that people are interested in reading. And it, again, feeds into this cycle of fear, victimage, and reaction.
Mm-hmm. And one of the things that's always been a hallmark of fascism everywhere is this particularly singling out one group of people in society for extra special torture and murder. You know, and that's when you talk about the racist aspect of all this. It's extremely important for people to understand how thick that is in all these developments.
Absolutely. I mean, and when it always comes back to, I mean, during the campaign, I mean, all these things were seeded there, if not before, but really rose to kind of national prominence in terms of the campaign and then the presidency. This notion of, well, what about black-on-black crime? Again, this way of turning the narrative upside down and then regurgitating this really racist slander, saying, well, you know, people of color, blacks in particular, just are inherently violent. And so anytime you talk about black death, you have to look at their communities first. And we see the same thing going on in terms of Islamophobia, you know, Muslims, Arabs, they all are, you know, uncontrollable and, inclined toward violence. And so that's why we need these repressive measures, because they're coming for us. And of course, nothing could be further from the truth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Now, I have a question just to end this segment real quick. How dangerous is it right now?
I think that it's a very hard question to answer, because every time you try to answer anything about, you know, or how do you predict this is going to work out or not, something else happens that astounds you. So I think it's incredibly dangerous. I mean, if you look at it through the angle of what would stop it from getting it worse. There's nothing that's going to stop it from getting it worse. Everything that we've seen is Trump or his minions latching on something, making it an issue, and using it to build the fire even higher. So, you know, the firing of Sessions, the Mueller, I mean, all these things are really uncontrolled and uncontrollable, it seems, at this point, which is, again, why we need people on the streets. We really need to keep demonstrating and showing our resistance and that we're not going to go away. And yet we have to be mindful of how dangerous the situation is. Mm-hmm. And the best way to defend ourselves is through mass action. It's not, you know, the smaller the group, the more vulnerable one is.
All right, David Palumbo-Liu, thank you very much for joining us today.
It's been wonderful. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, look forward to talking to you again, man.
Yeah, same here.
David, so let me ask you this. This is, and I know this is, we're done the main part of the interview, but I know that you're very active in the Palestinian issue and the justice for the Palestinian people. And just recently, we had some people on the show talking about the Students for Justice in Palestine who were trying to have their conference at the at UCLA, and they were fighting like hell to actually be able to do it. The city council was against them, and they finally said, okay, you forced us to let you do it, but, you know, they've encouraged the, you know, these various Zionist, fascistic people to come in and do it, check this out and watch what's going on, all of this stuff. And you just wrote, when I was reading your pieces, I came on something you wrote about the assault on John Chaney Lippold. And right. I wanted you to talk about that, because it's really important in relation to this overall assault, but both in relation to what we've just been talking about going on socially here in this country, but also the overall assault on the Palestinian people in the world.
Right. Well, there are two things that need to be mentioned. One is in terms of Professor Chaney Lippold. He is a supporter of the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement, and part of the thing that BDS asks its supporters to do is to not normalize relations with Israeli institutions, including Israeli institutions of education, which are complicit with the occupation and the suppression of Palestinian rights. And so a student of his at the University of Michigan asked him to write a letter of recommendation that would allow her to participate in a study abroad program in Israel. And John Cheney Leopold refused on the basis of the fact that those programs are, again, part of Israeli state institutions and are complicit in the occupation and the oppression of the Palestinians. But more pointedly, those study abroad programs are incredibly discriminatory. Arab Americans, Palestinians for sure, and other people that the state of Israel designates as undesirable, I mean, people that are protesting against it, are not eligible to participate in those study abroad programs. And my piece that was actually picked up by the Washington Post argued that if you look at the non-discriminatory policies of the University of Michigan, which are fine, John was essentially upholding the value and the ethos of non-discrimination. But the University of Michigan has come out against BDS, and yet at the point that he decided not to write the letter, there was no rule against a professor not writing a letter of recommendation. In fact, they said professors have wide latitude. If you don't have the time, that's fine. But they used this occasion to create a policy that would then make it illegal. So he's been hit by that. They punished him without due process. There was no investigation. They simply said, okay, you're not going to get a merit raise. You're not going to get a sabbatical. Your classes are going to get monitored. And the American Association of University Professors has protested that lack of due process. So that's one thing. In terms of Students for Justice in Palestine, and this is another really important point for your listeners to know, it's this, this conflation of criticism of the state of Israel with anti-Semitism. This is the one tool in their toolbox that they use to hammer people that are working for Palestinian rights. And even, you know, Democrats like Cory Booker, who makes this great performance at the Kavanaugh hearings, endorses these anti-boycott bills saying that they're anti-Semitic. But it's like saying that those who worked for civil rights in the United States were racist against whites. No, they were looking at discriminatory, oppressive policies, and it was irrelevant what race was being the agents of it. It was what the policies were. And Omar Barghouti, who is one of the co-founders of BDS, often says, "You know, listen, he doesn't care if the people that were oppressing them were Martians. You know, you want to remove the heel of the oppressor from your neck." And yet, the Zionist lobby is continuing to use this, well, no, you're anti-Semitic, when indeed Jewish Voice for Peace, B'Tselem, a number of Rabbis for Peace, a lot of Jewish groups and organizations have come out in support of the Palestinians. So there's no way to responsibly call it anti-Semitic, but that's the only tool in their toolbox, and they're using it to death.
Mm-hmm. All right, David, I want to thank you very much for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me on. Talk to you later.
Sure. Bye now. This is the Michael Slate Show, and we've been talking with David Palumbo Liu, the Louise Hewlett Nixon Professor at Stanford University. David is a professor of comparative literature and English, and we've been talking about an important article he recently wrote called "Trump's Embrace of Nationalist Label is Final Link to Dangerous Pattern." And at the end, he also said a word about the punishment of John Cheney Leopold, a University of Michigan professor who respected the call to boycott Israel and declined to write a letter of recommendation for a student who wished to study in Israel. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back, so stay tuned. Welcome back. That was Savage Rose with Not in Our Name. This summer, Bob Avakian, BA, the leader of the revolution and the architect of a new framework for revolution, the new synthesis of communism, or the new communism, gave a talk called Why We Need an Actual Revolution and How We Can Really Make Revolution. Now, this is a two-part talk that you can watch online at revcom.us. We're going to hear an excerpt from the Q&A that followed the talk.
My question has to do with how to go to work on people who are actually showing a kind of fighting spirit. And I'm talking about people like even in the middle strata right now who are confronting politicians, you know, while they're out to dinner, these mm-hmm. fascist politicians, people who are not allowing even just the average citizen, the fascist brown shirt to harass them, but are actually like fighting back in some sort of sense. When I hear these stories, what I see is like the potential of people to actually act outside of what the Democrats are telling them to do. Because basically the Democrats have said, no, be civil. Trump and, you know, the regime is constantly coming up with all these policies, these fascist policies, and emboldening these fascists to do things like this. They're leaving people, you know, twisting in the wind. You know, and I'm actually reminded of that line in Neil Young's Ohio, we're finally on our own. This kind of fighting spirit that people have shown has to get like bigger. And I'm wondering, as revolutionaries, how do we draw that out of people? Not just the basic masses, but people in the middle strata too, and even in the upper class.
Well, I think one of the things about, you know, any serious movement, and certainly a revolutionary movement, is it has to be very bold. Nobody's going to be attracted to something, you know, if you're saying that you want to change the whole world, you want to go up against the whole system, but you come off as if you're, you know, kind of conservative. it's not going to really come across to people as real. You know, in other words, by conservative, I mean if you're kind of like always playing by the rules and, you know, always playing it close to the vest. Now, let me be clear. We should not be reckless. I talked about the fact that there's going to be sacrifice, but we should really not have unnecessary losses and sacrifices. But you do have to take risks to change the world, and certainly you have to take risks to make a revolution. And you do have to be bold if you want to capture the imagination of people, even people, as you were saying, in the, you know, coming from the middle classes, let alone, you know, people who are, you know, catching hell every day. You got to be bold. And we, you know, we have to find ways to be out there really being bold. And I think, you know, I think this is great, this incivility that's going on. You know, all this talk about civility, well, yes, it's true. History has proven over and over again that if you're very civil toward fascists and you don't do anything to upset or anger them, they won't do anything bad. History has proven that over and over again, right? No. You know, they're going to do what they're going to do, and they're only too happy to have you roll over and play dead and be civil with them so that they can keep right on doing what they're doing with less obstacles in the way. So, you know, I think it's great what people are doing. You know, I mean, you know, they're not physically attacking them. You know, in fact, it's the fascists who physically attack people and threaten people. But they are hounding them in a very good way. They're letting them be known that we don't accept what you're all about. It's not, you know, we're not going to say it's normal. We're not going to say it's acceptable. We're not going to say that you can just go about doing this and we're going to treat you as if you are, you know, are deserve to be respected. And I think there needs to be a lot more of that. You know, not just the hounding of individuals, but a lot more bold actions that really galvanize what this is actually about, that really sharply bring out what the stakes are with this regime. I mean, look at how they're doing things. Whoever heard of they're breaking all the bourgeois rules. You know, all the rules of how the system has been operating, they're breaking them all the time. Look, who ever heard of a candidate, in recent times anyway, who ran for president, you know, and, you know, said that his opponent should be locked up. I mean, right there, that should have told all these people that all your civility is not going to get you anywhere. You know, they have, remember, you watched the Republican convention and the Trump rallies, lock her up, lock her up. And look, Hillary Clinton represents what she does. She's a, you know, she's a warmongering representative of this system who would have done terrible things had she been president, you know, and has done terrible things as Secretary of State and in other key positions. But, you know, there was something really disgusting about that whole lock her up thing, not just, the breaking of the conventions of how their politics is supposed to go, but there was a definite element of male chauvinism in all this, you know, of just misogyny. You know, like, look, Hillary Clinton is no champion of women or anyone else, but she was certainly attacked by many of these people because she was a woman as well as, you know, for other reasons. And it was really disgusting. And you know, this is just another, I mean, you can go down the line, you know, to all the things that they're doing. And people have to be broken out of the idea, you know, the fascists are going about trampling on and breaking down and destroying all these norms of how things are supposed to be done because they have to in order to implement their program. If they play by the rules as they've been, they'll get bogged down and they won't be able to implement what they're setting out to do. So they're trampling on and breaking down all these norms, and the answer of the Democrats is we will oppose them by upholding all the norms that they're destroying. We will use all the norms that they're destroying to oppose them. You know, that's like somebody, you know, set your house on fire and burn your house to the ground, and you say, I'm going to use my house as a base from which to oppose those people who burned it down. You know, this is the idiocy, because they are that section of the ruling class. That's how they believe that the only way that society should be run, number one, and number two, they are deathly afraid of people breaking out of those norms and, you know, taking to the streets and doing what people have done anytime there has been any meaningful change, even short of revolution. You know, they're deathly, they don't, you know, if there's protest at a hall, it has to be very, you know, choreographed and ritualized and within a certain framework, and it always has to be brought back to be sure you go out and register and vote. This is, you know, people take to the streets, you know, around the whole, Trump and women, you know, the Women's March. Be sure you vote, you know. All these youth pour out into the streets after this school shooting in Florida. Be sure you go out and vote. I mean, it's like they want to keep everything within these channels, and they're deathly afraid of people breaking out of those channels. And that's exactly what needs to happen if there's going to be any meaningful chance to actually, you know, prevent this fascist regime from further consolidating its rule and carrying out its horrific program. So the people who understand that now need to be very bold, not only in getting that message out, but without being reckless, also be very bold and act in what they do, in their actions. What you do, as well as what you say, has to be consistent with what you recognize. And what you say, the actual risks and stakes are of this situation. If that's my point about coming off conservative, is if you're conservative. If you say things are very extreme, the dangers are very great, the risks are very high, but then you act as if that's not the case, then there's even less chance people are going to take you seriously. So you have to, in everything we do, we have to challenge people, not stupidly, not in an infantile manner, not in a way that, you know, just sort of needlessly and gratuitously insults people, but in a way that challenges them, in a way that both challenges and provokes and inspires them. And that goes for everything. That goes for building this mass movement to drive out this regime through nonviolent but sustained massive protests. And it goes for the whole revolution and building that revolution. You have to be acting in a way that's consistent with what you say the problem and the solution is, and not in a way that contradicts it and makes people think that you don't really believe it. So I think there needs to be a lot more of, you know, a lot of times small things can contribute to big things eventually happening or happening even soon. You know, it's not just one little thing adds up, but sometimes even smaller scale things can lead to this, you know, geometric or whatever you want to call it, exponential growth, where things grow by leaps and bounds because people get provoked and inspired, and all of a sudden the dam break. What we need to be working for is the dam to break. There are tens of millions of people who are really upset and angry about this, and they do come out, you know, they came out around the immigrant children, they do come out around different things, but the dam hasn't broken to where they say, to hell with playing by the rules here, and to hell with listening to the Democratic Party insist that we have to play by the rules and be civil. We've got to take to the streets. I mean, look, I, you know, if you took one of their infamous polls, I feel very confident in saying that the great majority of people who are upset about Trump and everything represented by that, and not enough recognizing Pence, but never, people would agree with that. But then there's the question, are they going to act on it? And the ways have to be found to both challenge and provoke as well as inspire them to actually act on that and keep going at it in different ways until that dam breaks and they do actually bring their own actions in line with what they, with their sentiments, which has not yet happened.
That was Bob Avakian on how to spread the fighting spirit confronting fascists despite what Dems say. This is from the Q&A that followed a speech he gave this summer, Why We Need an Actual Revolution and How We Can Really Make Revolution. You can access the whole talk as well as several excerpts from the Q&A at revcom.us. We're going to take a quick musical break and be right back with Sansara Taylor. Now we're going to hear from Sansara Taylor, a writer for revcom.us Revolution newspaper and a co-initiator of Refuse Fascism.
Who is a correspondent for Revolution newspaper, the voice of the Revolutionary Communist Party, and one of the co-initiators of this group, Refuse Fascism.
All right, how y'all feeling today?
All right.
Listen up. I want to talk about the elections that just happened. I want to talk about the future that we are facing of fascism. And I want to talk about the revolution we need. Now, a lot of people are telling us we should celebrate and breathe a sigh of relief. But I want to say that the face of the future is not these newly minted Democrats who just gained the majority in Congress. They're not the naive Democratic Socialists. They're not the war hero Democrats who ran on being veterans of these imperialist wars. The future is not the female candidates who are going to put a facelift on a grotesque imperialist system. The real future and the face of the future that we are facing is the looks of horror and desperation on the children on the caravan who are fleeing the made in USA hell in Honduras and Guatemala. The real future we are facing is the whole wave of violence that led into this election. The massacre at the synagogue, the racist murders in Kentucky, the pipe bombs to anybody who dared to oppose Trump, even in the media. That is the face of the future under the Trump-Pence regime. Troops to the border with orders to shoot migrants. This is the future, and none of that changed with the Democrats winning the House. We have to be sober about this. These Democrats normalized all this. They changed the subject. They run along. They are accommodating, and it is up to us to stop them. No one is going to stop them but us. Let's be real, people. The demonization of immigrants, the ethnic cleansing, that is not going to stop. That is going to go forward under this regime and under this system. The war against women, against women's right to control their bodies and reproduction, their right to be free of sexual harassment and violence, the right to walk this earth like full human beings, that is going to be under even greater fire. That is the future under the Trump-Pence regime. The environment, the destruction and ripping up of environmental protections that has accelerated under Trump. This destruction of our planet, that is the future. That is not going to stop under this regime or under this system. The white supremacy, the whipping up of lynch mobs, that has been how Trump campaigned. Tens of thousands of people every night in his lynch mob rallies. The encouragement to police to violently, aggressively assault, brutalize, mass incarcerate, and murder our people, black and brown people in this country. That is not stopping. That is going forward. All of this and the imperialist wars of aggression, the threats of nuclear war, the violation of other countries, all of this is not stopped. This is going forward. We have to face the future for what it is. But I also want to talk about the future that could be, sisters and brothers, because that is not the only future. It is possible to put an end to all of this. None of this is necessary. This goes against the will and the interest of the majority of humanity. But it is not going to stop unless and until we make a revolution that gets rid of this system out of which all of these horrors have sprung and out of which the fascism we are now facing has grown. We need a revolution. And when I say revolution, I'm not talking about a new face on the system. I'm not talking about a few reforms. I am talking about overthrowing this system. Yes, overthrowing it, dismantling it, tearing it down, and implementing a radically new system. A revolutionary society as concentrated in the Constitution for the new socialist republic written by the revolutionary leader Baba Bakiev. We can make a whole different world. That is possible. And I am calling on you today to learn about this revolution and the strategy for this revolution by going to revcom.us, the website, and checking out the film, Why We Need an Actual Revolution and How We Can Make a Revolution by Baba Bakiev. Get into this. Lift your sights to a whole different world. Discuss it. Engage it. Come up to Revolution Books in Harlem and talk with us about it and spread it. And a key part of making this revolution is joining the fight right now, together with people from very different perspectives, to stand up against and, yes, to take to the streets in our millions and drive from power the fascist Trump-Pence regime before it destroys the ability for this planet to continue and human civilization. We have to join in this fight as part of building the strength and beating this system back and uniting with people from different perspectives, and we are doing it to contribute to a revolution, and we will stand shoulder to shoulder with everybody who refuses to accept a fascist America. Yeah. And in that, I want to recommend another film at revcom.us by Baba Bakiev called The Trump-Pence Regime Must Go. In the name of humanity, we refuse to accept a fascist America. Another world is possible. A better world is possible. Get into this film and spread it. We need to wake people up. We are out here. We are right to be out here today. We can't drink the Kool-Aid and go back to sleep and tell ourselves a fantasy about a blue wave that has supposedly solved things. It has solved nothing. Fascism is in power. It is barreling ahead. The Democrats are accommodating, and it is our responsibility to stand up and wake up our friends and our neighbors, spread the flyers for Saturday, go out to our churches, our students, our classmates, our professors, our congregants, our co-workers, our neighbors, and bring them into the streets with us this Saturday to stand up in even greater numbers and say this regime must go. And as you do, learn about this revolution. Get into this revolution. A whole different world is possible, and it's up to us. It's up to us to make that real. The Trump-Pence regime must go. Yeah. The Trump-Pence regime
must go.
The Trump-Pence regime
must go.
The Trump-Pence regime
must go.
Thank you very much.
That was Sansara Taylor, a writer for Revcom.us, Revolution Newspaper, and co-initiator of Refuse Fascism, which you can contact at refusefascism.org. We'll be right back. right, welcome back. That was Killing in the Name from Prophets of Rage. Now, as we go out, there's something I want to leave you with. It's a message from Refuse Fascism, and this was put out just in the aftermath of the recent elections. So check this out. Our mission, millions in the streets demanding, in the name of humanity, Trump-Pence must go. Our singular demand, in the name of humanity, the Trump-Pence regime must go. How does that happen? Every fascist move by the Trump-Pence regime should be met by more struggle and involve more and more people and diverse political forces opposed to the moves of this regime. And this struggle needs to be aiming at and preparing for nothing less than driving out the whole regime through the nonviolent massive struggle of people staying in the streets day after day, creating the kind of political crisis that could drive out the whole fascist regime. 1. The most defining thing about the recent elections is that the fascist program of the Trump-Pence regime became more consolidated and its fascist social base was more fully unleashed. Pipe bombs sent to leading Democrats and CNN. A hideous anti-Semitic massacre. Racist murders of African Americans. Vicious anti-immigrant lies of an invading caravan to be met by U.S. troops who Trump said should shoot if the refugees throw rocks. Trump whipping up his rallies, Nuremberg style, on top of 2 years of the regime eviscerating what are supposed to be civil and legal rights, banning Muslims, locking in a majority fascist Supreme Court, stoking violent white supremacy and xenophobia, hateful misogyny, and ripping up international alliances and ramping up the threats of war. The Trump-Pence regime and the forces within it have said they view this presidency as the last chance to secure their vision for this country. This will continue and grow worse, with Trump now firing Sessions, attacking reporters, doubling down on his racist nationalism, unless and until it is stopped by the masses of people acting in fierce and sustained opposition outside the confines of politics as usual. 2. The Democrats winning a majority in the House did not change this. The Democratic opposition throughout the elections and Nancy Pelosi's post-election speech refused to confront Trump's fascism, but instead normalized, accommodated, and then promised to collaborate with the regime that is bringing an American fascism. About the Democrats, it could be said, first they came for the Muslims, and I protested once and then let it happen. Then they came for the immigrants, and I voted for health care and stayed mum. They are determined to maintain order, even if that order is the order of fascism, rather than risk the instability that it would take to confront and drive out the fascist regime and the nightmare they are hammering into place. 3. The people who hate and fear this whole fascist nightmare and direction must now act with great determination in the streets, while organizing to move tens of thousands and soon millions to join them in the streets, with sustained determination until we drive this fascist regime from power in the name of humanity. This is why we are organizing a movement aiming to bring hundreds of thousands and millions into the streets to say, in the name of humanity, the Trump-Pence regime must go. This was a statement from Refuse Fascism, and you can go and access that statement yourself at refusefascism.org. And you'll also be able to find out all kinds of other information about things that Refuse Fascism is doing and its analysis of what's going on and what needs to be done. Once again, that's refusefascism.org. And that brings us to the end of yet another show. I want to thank all the people who worked on the show today. My assistant producer, Henry Carson, my production assistant, Jeff Pryor, and my engineer, Gary Bakke. If you want to write to me, you can at mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Once again, that's mslate@themichaelslateshow.com. Talk to you again next week.
Ein, zwei, drei, vier.
Strange things are happening, Lord, I don't know what to do. My friends say it's in my head, I say it's deja vu. It's all too familiar, been down this road before. I believe it was in Germany, just before the war. A meanness swept the land, stealing our hearts and the hands of time. Taking us back in history to a place on the darker side, where we saluted the flags of fear and the voice of ignorance roared. Taking us back to Germany just before the war. The balance of power shifted when the people cast their vote. Our lining up the victims, the villains and the scapegoats. And we're all singing hallelujah. Death penalty's been restored. Just like in Germany, just before the war. We used to feed the hungry, care for the disabled and the poor. We used to care about civil rights, but we don't give a damn anymore. We used to harbor the wretched refuse, but now we bar the door. Just like in Germany, just before the war.